So welcome, Solari fans. Harry Blazer here with a very special guest, Ilana Freeland. Ilana, say hello to the Solari subscribers.
Hello, Solari.
So, Ilana, who are you? Where did you come from? What do you do?
What planet am I from? I'm writing books. I've been a writer, I suppose, since I was 8 years old when my teacher accused me of plagiarism for a short story. But I've done many things in life and studied many things because I am a consummate student of everything. I feel that being alive on the planet is a great privilege and must be pursued with gusto. It's just that I didn't realize how deep this topic was when in 2011, I believe, Adam Parfrey at Farrell House asked me if I thought I could write a book on chemtrails. I had no idea how deep it was going to be, but now I've just completed my second book, as you know, and I'm on to the third and hopefully final book on this topic of the planetary assault going on right now.
So before we get into this, because the reason we're here is to discuss in particular your second book, Under an Ionized Sky. The first one in this series was Chemtrails, HARP, and the Full Spectrum Dominance of Planet Earth. And you have a third one coming out on synthetic biology to kind of complete this trilogy.
Yeah.
And we also have a whole other remarkable series called Sub Rosa America and the Fall of the New Atlantis. And that's a five-volume series. And we'll talk a little bit about all of these, but we're going to concentrate on Under an Ionized Sky. But before we get there, tell me a little bit more about yourself, where you grew up, what your education was, and a few more about your life experience.
Wow, nobody ever asks me about that. I was born in the United States, but I was raised the first few years of my life until I was eight by my Romanian grandparents while my mother worked at the Western Union. I grew up in an Eastern European neighborhood of about five square blocks in Detroit, Michigan. It had a huge impact on me because I was really raised around multiple languages and adults who could not speak English and children who could. So we had a lot of freedom, and I adored the music and the dancing and the deep humanity of the Eastern Europeans, all the way for Ukrainians, Russians. We had Poles. My godparents were Hungarian. My grandmother was a Roma gypsy, and very valued by the neighborhood for her ability to see into the old countries, to see how their relatives were doing. So I grew up with the idea that this world and other worlds are all converging in the human being and our consciousness. After the neighborhood, my mother and I finally left, and we moved to New York City, Manhattan, where she worked all the time. I was a latchkey kid, and we went to plays, we went to musicals on Broadway. It was wonderful, and I guess I didn't mind the loneliness of, she would often not get home until 9 at night, and I would make my dinner and watch an old movie or something. There were, like, we got three channels, I believe, then, And then I began to bounce around quite a bit because my parents were finally divorcing and I'd end up at different places. And that was probably tough on me. And I think my inner world began to get a lot more intense, as I recall. By 13, I'd moved out of my mother's home and went to live with my father for the first time in my life, really. He had remarried and had children, and I then became a popular girl in high school and cheerleader captain and student council and really a tremendous success socially, probably my first one. And then I was chosen to go to Girl State, which is mock state government for two students are chosen to represent their schools, their high schools, and I was chosen for some reason. And I went to Girl State, and my party had a huge success. I was the campaign manager, and then 800 girls voted to send me to Washington, D.C. to represent them in Girls Nation. And this is where I really feel that my political life began. I went to Girls Nation. I was elected or appointed, I don't remember, a Librarian of Congress. I spent the week with a group of girls under Lyndon Baines Johnson, who was the vice president then. John F. Kennedy was president. We went to the Rose Garden our next to last day there and had tea with President Kennedy. A huge seminal experience for me. He compared me to his wife. I did look a little bit like Jackie Kennedy then. And then I came back to my home state and gave talks to the civic groups that had paid for my trip. And then 4 months later, he was dead. And I had to return to those civic groups and give a talk about my day with Kennedy in front of sobbing Americans. It was a very, very deep experience for me. And so then from there, I came of age in the 60s. I was one of those fortunate people to experience an amazing renaissance of sorts in the United States. I was pretty naive. However, we in the 60s knew that John Kennedy had been assassinated from inside and that Oswald had had nothing to do with it, really. And then, of course, as you know, Martin Luther King was killed just a few years after that, and then just a few months after him, Robert Kennedy was killed. And so these were our three heroes, and my generation went into a very turbulent time in which they became subject to the CIA and FBI's COINTELPRO interference with our youth, I would say. Our rock stars were killed if they were political. All sorts of things were going on. And a lot of people remember the 60s as being sex, drugs, and rock and roll, but that's Time Magazine and Life Magazine take on it. My experience of it was we were all spiritual seekers and we were very political. So I wrote the Sub Rosa America series to correct the record, in a way, about my generation, which was just filled with Renaissance people, people with amazing intelligence, amazing skills, amazing joie de vivre. And hopefully Sub Rosa America does something to correct the incorrect record of the mainstream media. And then from there, I got involved in a variety of things, health. I studied Chinese medicine. I had spiritual experiences that changed my inner life over time. I became involved in Rudolf Steiner's ideas, and I was trained as a Waldorf teacher and started four schools in Washington State, along with many other people. And now I've been writing now for about 20 years, ghostwriting, writing people's books for them, because I know how to build books, and writing the Sub Rosa America series, and then writing the Chemtrails Harp book and the Under an Ionized Sky. I give talks. I'm on radio a lot. I'm trying to awaken people to what's going on right in front of our faces, but since we've been taught that our perceptions are not good enough, that we need experts, that we need high-tech devices, people don't really recognize what is happening to our planet. And those few who do are getting older and leaving the planet, dying. I think right away of Dr. Rosalie Bertell, epidemiologist par excellence, and she was the first one to say what I'm saying, which is that the planet is being weaponized by the military industrial intelligence complex. And so that's the path I've been on now for about 6 years.
So, Ilana, I would like you to do something for me because there's a fair amount of information about you on the net, but then also talks you've given so the subscribers can learn a lot from them. And at one of your recent talks in Santa Cruz where you were promoting your book, you opened with a, I don't know, 5-minute speech. I'd like you to give that now, and then we'll go from there.
Wonderful. I'd be pleased to do so. I wrote this speech, and it says something very important that I want people to know. The fact is, we are living in a strange science fiction time, not the least of which is how issues upon which the future welfare of the Earth and its peoples hinge are marginalized as conspiracy theory. And scientists and doctors who step forward to tell the truth are discredited, ostracized, or killed. High-tech research, whether at university, corporate, or government labs, is funded by the military and its myriad contractors, while compartmentalization, need-to-know security clearance, and non-disclosure agreements signed in blood keep the secrets as the patent office and good old boy peer review system play gatekeeper. Divide and hide is the name of the national security game. The internet, too, is compromised, but is the only town square and educational network we have. Every day, what lies beneath the national security shroud, thrown over full-spectrum dominance technologies, coming online daily at a pace that defies reason, must be reassessed. What university could we turn to for the kind of national security state information breaking daily, especially now that our university system is part of the military industrial intelligence complex? As a writer and student of my time, I seek to frame the context by which to interpret the pieces of a future already here. Like the Egyptian myth of Isis and Osiris that Freemasons are so fond of, the body parts of an ancient globalist dream to which we are all subject lie scattered around us, awaiting our ability to piece it all together and interpret what is being hidden from we the people. Our school conditioning was to keep issues compartmentalized and separate from each other. Geoengineering, GMOs, genetics, Wi-Fi, 5G, Morgellons, transhumanism, vaccinations, electromagnetic targeting of individuals and populations, mind control, etc. The truth is, they are all connected by a common globalist intent, just as CERN, ionospheric heaters, fracking wells, and wind turbines are all calibrated to work together for space fence control. The issues confronting us are separate battles in a vast, ongoing spiritual war for the future of humanity and definition of life itself. Extreme weather, water quality, immune system degeneration, creature extinctions, acid oceans, and alkalinized soil, all is occurring in tandem with the moral degeneration of society, the death of the middle class dream, the rise of Agenda 2030 and its artificial intelligence, optogenetics, and neuroscience. All are scenes grown large and wireless from the elite Luciferian dream known yesterday as internationalism and today as globalism. The Earth and its atmosphere are being geoengineered. And it is not just about weather, wireless communication, drones, and directed energy weapons. It is about aiding in the breakdown of the biosphere so all of life can be genetically altered and controlled. Hopefully, a contextualized bigger picture will help you decide on your own particular battle strategy. Once we are no longer fragmented and blinded by fear, we can examine the battle space drawn up by those who despise the long and slow evolution of human free will and seek instead to electromagnetically imprison us in a hive mind. May we draw courage from each other and our ability to see and share what we see. In his 2012 book, Covert Wars and Breakaway Civilizations, Joseph P. Farrell quotes General of the Army Douglas MacArthur in his farewell speech, Duty, Honor, and Country, at West Point, May 12, 1962. General MacArthur definitely was privy to the big picture. And I quote, "We deal now not with things of this world alone, but with the illimitable distances and as yet unfathomed mysteries of the universe. We are reaching out for a new and boundless frontier. We speak in strange terms of harnessing cosmic energy, of making winds and tides work for us, of creating unheard of synthetic materials to supplement or even replace our old standard basics, to purify seawater for our drink, of mining ocean floors for new fields of wealth and food, of disease preventatives to expand life into the hundreds of years, of controlling the weather for a more equitable distribution of heat and cold, of rain and shine, of spaceships to the moon, of the primary target in war, no longer limited to the armed forces of an enemy, but instead to include his civil populations, of ultimate conflict between a united human race and the sinister forces of some other planetary galaxy, of such dreams and fantasies as to make life the most exciting of all times." End of quote. The most exciting of all times may yet also prove to be the most dangerous of all times. General MacArthur was not waxing eloquent. He was already looking through the lens of the military doctrine of full-spectrum dominance, essential to a space age, more about Nikola Tesla and James Clerk Maxwell than Isaac Newton and Albert Einstein, a space age not of the law of conservation of energy, but of torsion fields, rotating plasmas transducing zero-point energy, manipulation of the local fabric of space-time, longitudinal scalar waves and interferometry weapons such as we saw on 9/11 without knowing what we were seeing. Warfare is now asymmetrical, and physics is now nonlinear. In near-Earth orbit and space, we have orbiting and geostationary satellites armed to the teeth with surveillance and directed energy weapons in the name of weather detection and media connectivity. We have sounding rockets spewing dusty plasma, smart dust and sensors, and sundry experiments in space, on the moon and sun, all directed by and run through quantum computers engaged in their own artificial intelligence evolution counter to ours. That's it.
Ilana, again, Under an Ionized Sky, and the subtitle is From Chemtrails to Space Fence Lockdown. Now, of course, chemtrails is a term that the alt media and the wackos invented, correct?
Chemtrails? It was invented by the U.S. Air Force Academy of that all good pilots go to.
Oh, hold on a second. You mean the wackos and alt media didn't invent the term chemtrails? It came out of the U.S. Air Force?
Yeah, right. Yeah, it's from the U.S. Air Force. And it was also in the executive summary for the High Frequency Active Auroral Research Project in Gakona, Alaska, known as HARP, that wonderful acronym. No, it comes from the military.
Okay, so hold on. I'll get the punchline here in a second. And this whole thing here, you talk about space fence. That's another thing that was invented by imaginary old weird people, right?
No, you know it was invented by the military. We had a space fence under SDI years ago, the Strategic Defense Initiative under Reagan, Bush, and Cheney.
But the word space fence, that's just something you invented, right?
No, that's their term.
You mean like Lockheed Martin?
Yeah, Lockheed Martin.
So you can go. So the reason I'm saying this, and I'll get to the punchline in a second, you can go to YouTube and just look at Lockheed Martin's space fence and see Lockheed Martin talking about their space fence. So what I want to mention is this. I got serious after I sold my business in 2001 to Whole Foods about trying to figure out the real deal. And that's when I spent some serious time with Catherine. But I was spending many, many hours a day for years just trying to understand. But starting with a very key issue that was dear to my heart, which was the Kennedy assassination, as it was dear to you. And I came across this very monumental book that changed my life, which was Fletcher Prouty's The Secret Team.
Uh-huh.
So that is always on my number one, you know, reading list for people that want to learn about the deep state. Because here's a guy that was basically the liaison between every intelligence operation in the military. And he never signed a non-disclosure. But he was one of the guys that had almost total visibility and then went on to talk about how things really work.
Yeah.
This book of yours is, to me, of equal importance. So in a way, I feel there's not been another book that is as important on the deep state and what we're facing as this book that you've come up with. Now, one of the reasons it's so important is it's incredibly well documented. When you make these claims that at first somebody just reading the text would go, huh? And then you have these, you know, and on every page, you know, 3, 4, 5 footnotes at the bottom. Oftentimes they refer directly to military documentation, prime sources, and researchers in the field. You do the same thing with your presentations on YouTube, especially the Santa Cruz thing. We're going to link to that. We're going to link to this. To Lockheed Martin's space fence thing. We're going to link to this Air Force document that you mentioned. But as I read your book, I mean, I always outline, but every page has copious linings. And then I also, on very, very key points, I use arrows. And there's more arrows in this book, I think, than any other book I've ever read. Okay, so I just want people to understand, and this is also on Catherine's, you know, books you must read to understand 2018 and the future and how to protect yourself. This is a masterpiece, Miss Freeland, and I've known you now for a number of years. I've been a big fan and supporter of yours, but I'm actually a little bit startled by the depth of the scholarship represented in this book. And you can no longer is there any doubt about chemtrails. Okay?
No.
What they call chemtrails. No longer is there any doubt about geoengineering. But even much more significant, no longer is there any doubt about this massive effort to control, to surveil, to almost create a prison planet, you know, like InfoWars, like Alex Jones. I always wondered why, you know, he calls himself prisonplanet.com. So yeah. Just take a minute, because I'm wanting to use this session as a relatively short one that introduces you to the subscribers who don't know you, but in more detail, and to introduce them to this book, and to introduce them to some key references that'll be in the notes. And I want to then come back in the future and spend serious time, maybe chapter by chapter, going over your book. That's how important it is. So, what's the space fence?
Well, yeah, thank you for those kind words. You are a real deep reader, I would say, Harry. And, of course, that's a challenge for many people today whose ability to concentrate has been greatly undermined by mainstream media and the technology that we now have for educating ourselves. The space fence, like I said, it started out with the Strategic Defense Initiative as a sort of necklace from east-west United States radar installations that were watching the sky. And they have continued that narrative now that they have the atmosphere ionized from the technology all the way from the chemical trails loaded with the nanoparticle heavy metals for conductivity to the ionospheric heaters, all the radar installations, all the NEXRADs across the United States, all the wind farms and the fracking wells and everything. I explained thoroughly the infrastructure of this tremendous effort to turn the entire planet into a surveillance instrument, yes, but also a lockdown in many, many ways. And they continue the narrative that the space fence is primarily counting debris rotating around the planet so that we can protect our satellites, which, of course, are essential. They are the eyes for all the military. But what they don't say is that the space fence is also able to see onto the planet. And the level of surveillance now, thanks to Billy Hayes, the HAARP man, who led me through one infrastructure element after another and pointed the way for my research, the ability to see down to a half centimeter from far distant space, a satellite, geostationary, or mobile, is extraordinary. And I think this is part of our problem of why even when people hear me talk or read, they have a hard time imagining the level of control that is going on now that we have an entirely wireless world and wireless technology that people are addicted to, and all of these being what the military calls dual use. These are all about using it for military objectives while making profits from civilians for their convenience and comfort and entertainment. So it's pretty big. I completely admit that, and that's what I try to show and sort of break it down a bit for people to get hold of how it's working together through calibrating these instruments and through the pulsing of frequencies. This concept of pulsing frequencies, I mean, everybody's going to have to get beyond their high school science courses and get interested in the technology that they're dependent on now. They're going to have to learn how it works a bit, and that's what I try to get going by writing the Under an Ionized Sky.
Now, when I take a look at NASA's website, they describe the atmosphere in terms of primarily four layers. And five layers. So, and there's a troposphere, which is basically from the surface to 5 to 9 miles up. The stratosphere, which is from the troposphere up to 31 miles, which includes the ozone layer. There's the mesosphere, which goes from the stratosphere up to 53 miles. There's the thermosphere, which goes from the mesosphere up to 372 miles. And then there is the exosphere, with an upper limit of up to 6,200 miles. Now, there's this other thing called the ionosphere, which I found very interesting. It's an abundant layer of electrons and ionized atoms and molecules that stretches from 30 miles to edge of space, some 600 miles up, overlapping into the mesosphere and thermosphere.
That's right.
So people think of the ionosphere as being like one of those layers. It's actually not. It's a combination, and it is where, and tell me if I'm wrong, that's really where they're concentrating in terms of creating this space fence and ionizing the planet. Is that correct?
Well, the space fence is going all the way from, at the top of the ionosphere. A lot of the things that are creating what I think of as the space fence in near-Earth orbit, I think of the ring around the planet, and that's the illustration I have on the book cover. That ring, like a Saturn ring, it sort of rests around the equator and probably starts up at the top, I would guess, of the stratosphere. It's not that high up, not as high as the top of the ionosphere by any means, but it is essential to have that level of metal conductivity in nanoscale. And most of that, of the ring around the planet that is forming because of centrifugal force, is because of the spewing that rockets leave, especially the sounding rockets that really don't go much higher than the top of the stratosphere and then come back down. They're testing various things up there. That's why they're called sounding rockets. And they will spew particularly lithium from their combustion chambers on their way up. And those nanoparticles of that lithium and whatever else is being spewed will eventually rest in that ring and is producing a ring very similar to that around Saturn. And what I try to point out as the book progresses is how that ring is about the lockdown. If you can imagine that you would have it's a very much a communication device, sort of like a CD disc would be, a CD-ROM would be my picture of it. It can hold information. It is essential to communications, over the horizon communications, yes, from the ionizing that has gone on in our atmosphere since we're zapping the ionosphere with our ionospheric heaters. And it would also have to do with communication with vessels going out, craft going out into the solar system. So, to me, it's the space fence is primarily about kind of holding us between that ring and creating sort of a dome of extra low frequency, ultra low frequency ionization around the planet. We're really in it now. It's not a matter of the future. We're in it now. They came out recently with an article about how this ULF buffer has formed around the Earth. Well, that has to do with the outer ring of the ring itself around the planet down to the installations on the ground. We are held in that vice grip of that communication Tesla dome in a way. You could think of it as a Faraday cage as well, except that we're kind of trapped inside it. So that's my conception of the space fence, that it's far more than counting debris in space and protecting our satellites. It's actually a means to have full spectrum dominance over planet Earth before they set out for the rest of the space age, which will have to do with the other planets.
So we've kind of made the planet into a wireless network
Yeah, and it, you know, you mentioned Prison Planet. I think of C.S. Lewis's part of his trilogy, his science fiction trilogy. His third book is called Out of the Silent Planet. And I've been spooked many times while writing the second book. It just sounds so much like what he described, where we are cut off from the cosmos. We cannot hear the cosmos. The cosmos cannot hear us. I mean, this is dire. We can't see the stars at night. You know, we're doing without 22% of our sunlight. We have 18% less oxygen in our bodies. We are, in a way, becoming the silent planet.
So there's this gentleman named Clifford Connicum who wrote the introduction to your book. Who is Clifford Connicum, and how did you get to know him?
Well, Clifford is the independent scientist who really was the very first clarion call of trying to wake us up back in the late 90s. When he and his wife were living in northern New Mexico, and Clifford was observing in the sky, that beautiful azure sky of New Mexico, these long white trails that would slowly dissipate into a thin cirrus cloud cover. And he began to collect data from his HEPA filter and from precipitation. He had been a scientist for the Department of Defense and the Bureau of Land Management and had quit all that and become a computer consultant. But he, you know, in his spare time began to look at this data. He, of course, constantly was on a shoestring budget and really needed much more sophisticated equipment, but he's very innovative and was able to look at a lot of things. And when I got back from England, I lived in England for a few years, and I came back to Santa Fe, where I'd gone to grad school, and that's when I met Clifford through a friend, and we all began to have breakfast together, and Clifford and I would end up talking about what he'd found recently. It's sort of, I was very interested because of the files I was keeping for the Sub Rosa America series that I was writing. And I had one on chemtrails and one on HARP. And it was through Clifford that I began to realize that the two were really very integrally set up together to produce a certain kind of atmosphere. And Clifford, he collected my blood and my saliva, and I looked under his microscope and saw the Morgellons creature that he had really discovered and was trying to analyze and test in various petri dishes. I saw it sucking the iron out of my red blood cells under his microscope. And you can imagine how wakeful that experience was. And then I eventually came back to the Northwest, and that's when Adam Parfrey at Farrell House asked if I could write a book on chemtrails, because I'd done some work for Adam while I was in England, and I think he was trying to give me a chance to publish a little broader.
So in addition to the lithium that's being dispersed, obviously aluminum and barium nanostyle have been major components. But the other thing that Clifford has told us is that there's biologics being dispersed as well.
Yes, along with the sensors that are also nanoscale and the microprocessors, which are tiny computers on the nanoscale. We've inhaled all of these. And the biologicals, the Morgellons, is probably only one of the biologicals that is being tested. See, when you're talking about planetary control, you're going to have to have more than a lab or even 100 labs to experiment with. You're going to have open field experiments. And that's kind of how I see what's going on now. When I say the atmosphere is ionized, I'm talking about plasma. We have the fourth state of matter now completely in our atmosphere. We're not breathing the same air we were breathing 50 years ago. It's a heated, this is heated because the atmosphere is electric ready all the time, especially with the heavy metals that are falling slowly, lofting down. That's why they like the nano scale more than the micron scale, because you can have a longer drift rate down from the stratosphere where the jets are laying these and also the rockets. So, you know, it's an open lab in the sky. I'm on Facebook a lot and on internet, and people are discovering these things with no context. They have no scientific context for them. So, of course, they think they're UFOs, they think they're aliens, they think whatever. But a lot of this is, a lot of plasma research is going on in our skies. And anytime you see something that is luminous and, you know, sort of like zipping across the sky, they'll tell you it's a meteor or an asteroid in the newspaper, but that's a disinformation to cover over the national security status of all of this that is going on. This is all under wraps, and that's why it's important to again return to our perception and to believe, all right, I'm seeing something, but I don't have the right context. I need to study. I need to read something. And that was my hope, was that I could give people enough to read to get them started on realizing what is up there, what's going on, the space age that we're already in.
Plasma, an ionized gas consisting of positive ions and free electrons in proportions, resulting in more or less no overall electric charge, typically at low pressures, as in the upper atmosphere and in fluorescent lamps, or at very high temperatures, as in stars and nuclear fusion reactors. So plasma's real. It's even recognized by science, although it's a little hard to get scientists to recognize scalar waves unless you look in the right places. They've been dealing with them
right.
for decades.
Yeah, they're calling them gravity waves, the gravitation waves, and that's okay, because in a way they are like, scalar waves are like that, but the important thing is that we are witnessing scalar technology, and the scalar waves are different from electromagnetic waves, but each can be converted into the other, and that's going on as well. And that's primarily the ionospheric heaters. But anyway, for that, I always recommend that people read someone who really knows a lot about it, and that would be Tom Bearden. And in Europe, it would be Constantine Meil, M-E-Y-L, who is by many considered the next Tesla.
So hopefully this has served as a potent enough introduction to get people interested in getting your book, looking at some of the presentations we're going to have in the link. And then I want to follow up, because in your book, we've got an introduction, Planetary Lockdown, Geoengineering in the Deep State, Catching Up with Chemtrails, HARP. Chapter one is Project Cloverleaf, which is a historical project that creates a lot of context for all this. You've got chapter two, Aether or Ether, Plasma and Scalar Waves. Chapter 3, The Nano Assault. Chapter 4, Sky Anomalies. Chapter 5, The Revolution in Military Affairs. Chapter 6, Mastering the Human Domain. Chapter 7, The Star Wars Space Fence Rises Again. Chapter 8, Boots on the Ground. 9, The Temple of CERN. 10, The Covert Ascendance of Technocracy. 11, The Unlawful Silent War Against Citizens. And then a very interesting conclusion, which is cure yourself and some recommendations about how to protect yourself. But let me just make two quick comments. I spent a lot of time in the woods in Montana, and I love to hike. Been doing it since 69. And what I will tell you is, there is a qualitative difference in the experience between then and now. And two of the things I can say is, the sky is no longer blue. Second, the trees are no longer really healthy. And when dead trees fall on, and come across the road where I live and so on, you know, I'm there, I have to cut them up and turn them away. They are lighter. They don't have as much substance. They are have internal porosity that wasn't there. And people blame it on the beetles and droughts and this type of thing. No, the beetles are there because all the damn aluminum that's been bombarding, among other things, bombarding our ecosphere here. Now, the question is, how the hell could this be going on in front of our face for decades now? And you can't get one government official, you can't get one national government, you can't get anybody to come clean about what's going on. Now, you get bits and pieces here and whistleblowers. And then, of course, you can look at the documentation and a book like yours that's put it all together to see, well, of course it's going on. Who has the power on this planet to make this happen? And maybe that also explains a little bit about these $21 trillion of undocumented adjustments in the DOD and HUD budget that Catherine's been talking about for ages. So, you know, who has this kind of power? Because I think that question, in a way, has to be answered. Otherwise, people say, well, this could never happen. How could you get everybody to just never say anything about it?
Well, that's an easy answer for me. I spent so much time when writing Sub Rosa America about, I spent the time trying to walk in the shoes, in a way, of the global elites and what they were like. I was fortunate to have a couple of clients when I was ghostwriting who are from those families. So I was able to learn from them about pretty horrendous childhoods in preparation for wielding the power that they would have to wield as members of these dynastic families. So I would have to begin with dynastic families, and the ones I always think of are the ones who walked away from World War II richer than they had ever been, and that would be the big pharma families of Europe. And next would be organizations formed by the dynastic families and vast international corporations, which dominate all the major industries that leech off of the poor, primarily. And they all formed the Council on Foreign Relations, the Trilateral Commission. And the fascinating thing is, like the chemtrails term that became a tinfoil hat term, but it was really a term that belonged to the military. The same thing happened with the dynastic families, the Rockefellers, all the usual suspects. They became conspiracy theories, and yet they were as close to the truth as you can get. But they were used to discredit people. So there's some very sly capability in these people who are able to continue from generation to generation and maintain and double the wealth of their family or their corporation or however you look at it. These are the people running things. They're running the military. I mean, I constantly try to use the term military-industrial intelligence complex because, you know, there's a lot of good people in the military. There's a lot of good people in the intelligence apparatus. There's a lot of good people in any of these. But as a conglomerate and a top-down structuring, a hierarchic structuring. And then, of course, in Sub Rosa America, I go much deeper into the occult aspect, which has to be mentioned, that a lot of these people at the top of the rungs of these families and corporations are very savvy to a lot of things that are considered occult, or, you know, as the word occult means, hidden. So it's not hard for me to figure out how this happens. And you use fear and you use greed as whips to keep people in line. You take film of them in pedophile acts and you maintain those files, that you will have slaves forever who will do your will. And that certainly is how it works. It's just that we, the people, we've been slow to come to this knowledge, particularly in the United States, because we were bought off for decades by convenience and toys and two cars in every garage and et cetera, et cetera, in the capitalist dream. So we're slow on the uptake. And it's only now that we're going to begin suffering that people are finally interested. I mean, I've been a radical for all these decades and lived on the edge of society in order to keep awake and to keep doing my work. You know, being able to teach, certainly, because I'm certified to teach, but still, you have to remain awake and not drift into all the desires and pleasures offered by a religion of materialism, which is basically what this country has chosen to have.
Well, I'm feeling safer and safer because, after all, our youth and our progressive youth and progressive Z, X, and millennial generations are out there telling us that the real enemy is the NRA and we should give up our assault rifles.
Or the Russians.
Right. Right. Yeah, and the Russians are right.
Bringing that one back.
So, Alana, this has been, I think, an effective introduction. I want to come back to you, circle around, and go into much more depth. But hopefully this will encourage folks to get your book, study your book, study some of the links that we've given them. Because I don't know of a more important subject than this. I also don't know of anything that connects the dots more than this. So yeah. I'm honored to be a friend, supporter, and I'm also just very grateful that you have put in this work and continue to for your next volume, Synthetic Biology, which will kind of complete the trilogy on that side.
Right.
So with that, I can say goodbye right now, but not, you know, adieu, but not goodbye, I guess they say. You know, not farewell, but adieu. Because we'll be back at it. Is there anything else that you'd like to tell the listeners before we sign off on this one?
Well, they can find the books, of course, at Amazon. And Feral House is the publisher. And yes, I do hope that people will read, even if it's a few paragraphs a day, just to because knowledge is power. I know that this is the way. There is no marching in the streets against this one. There's no petitions against this one. There's no democratic process for this one. This is national security, and our greatest hope is to teach ourselves what the technology is, what it can do, and then to make the changes in our lifestyles to prepare for the effects of those technologies.
And do you have a website? And that's ELANA. Freeland, FREELAND.
Yes, yes, and then they can also find me on Facebook. I have two closed Facebook sites. They can just ask for membership.
So, Ilana, thank you so much for your time today, and we will be back with each other, I hope, in the very near future.
Oh, thank you so much, Harry. This has been a pleasure.